Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com. Welcome to another podcast at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and also Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. Joining us now is Dr. Jill Underley. She is the superintendent of instruction in the Pecatonica School District. She also is, she's had teaching experience and education experience at a number of levels. She is a candidate for school superintendent in Wisconsin, that election coming up in April. First of all, Jill, congratulations on making it through the primary.
Well, thank you so much, Sly. It was really great. It's a good feeling. It was a big primary with really wonderful people, so it was nice to, get our issues elevated to the top.
So you have been endorsed by some of the people that you defeated in the primary?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Let me ask you about your background. If a lot of people are still getting to know who you are, and why you think it makes you uniquely qualified to become the chief of the Wisconsin schools.
Sure. So I have experience in a broad range of areas in public schools. I've been working for public schools since 1999, if you want to count my years prior to that as a substitute teacher. But I have experience in urban as well as rural and suburban. I also have experience from the youngest ages in pre-K and preschool child care all the way up, as a teacher and then an administrator principal. And then I was also, I worked at UW-Madison in student affairs with first-generation college students who were struggling. I also worked at DPI, so that's the department that I hope to get elected to on April 6th. So my experience goes all the way through, earliest years all the way through state administration.
Why do you want to move to this position? Obviously, you've got a great job. You're popular in your district. Why do you want to take this on? Not an easy job.
No, it's not. And I'll be honest, I ask myself that question now every day. No, it's not that at all. I think the reason I want to take on this job is because I've had all these experiences and I understand how the whole system works. And it's a system for sure. It's K-12 schools, it's the tech colleges, it's the UW system, it's the state administration, it's the policies and it's the research that ties everything together. It includes our libraries, and I've always been a continuous learner. I'm passionate about public education, and I believe, honestly, that every child every day should have access to a great public education, because I feel that that is the solid foundation that builds them up for the rest of their lives. So that's why I want to do it.
You've watched other superintendents. Mm-hmm. This has been an elected position since the early 70s. I remember being in middle school when this all, maybe even in elementary when this all started. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, as you've watched all the superintendents come and go, mm-hmm. is there one thing where you go, God, here's something that we should do that nobody has gotten done?
Sure.
And not putting any blame on them, just something that you might do differently than any previous superintendent.
And I'll be honest, it's tough, right? Because as this state superintendent, you're corralling so many different interests and working with the legislature, which can be difficult, too, to get things done. We don't have a state school board in Wisconsin, which is great, because the state superintendent certainly has more policy freedom, you know, and implementing those policies. But I guess one thing I would do differently would be that I would use DPI as more of that bully pulpit. You know, there's so many things that are great about our public schools, and then there's also some things that are happening behind the scenes that are draining resources from our public schools, and I don't feel that the vast majority of people in Wisconsin are aware of how our public school funding system works. And so I would certainly use the DPI as that bully pulpit to, you know, shout from the top of the roof of Jeff 3 in downtown Madison that these are the great things that are happening. However, you need to know that, you know, this is also happening, and this is how funding works, or this is, you know, what's, you know, taking resources out of our schools.
Usually, the bully pulpit means going out there and creating a little bit of controversy, because for some reason, just talking about harmony doesn't usually get you media attention. Mm-hmm. Does this mean taking on the legislature?
No, I don't think necessarily taking on the legislature in an overt way. I do feel that, you know, like when we talk about school funding, however, the legislature controls the budget. You know, DPI could certainly promote and advocate for the kinds of things they like. You know, for example, reimbursing special education costs at, you know, more than what they are right now, which is abysmal at 28%. But also the legislature controls all the other programs that get funding, you know, that comes out of our education budget for the state, such as like the privatization of our, you know, some of our schools. And, you know, they want to, right now, that's a really big amount of money that I don't think most people in Wisconsin understand, you know, that we are transferring money from our public schools into the private schools. And I'm certainly not against private schools. I feel that there is a place for them in the fabric of our education in Wisconsin, but I don't feel that our public tax dollars should be paying for them. And so I think, you know, when you talk about putting pressure on the legislature, I feel that that would come from the constituents. You know, I feel like once people realize, you know, what this is and how it's harming public schools, particularly our urban schools, and you look at Milwaukee and the amount of money that is transferred out of MPS to privatization interests, I think people would be outraged, and then they would put that pressure on their legislators.
You know, my mother taught fourth grade at Lee Street School in Milwaukee before I was born. And back in those days, unfortunately, women were basically told to retire once they started having children, teachers, mm-hmm. which is yeah. a travesty. Mm-hmm. But even at the end of her life, and she only taught maybe 6-7 years before she had kids, she had a form of dementia. You know, mm-hmm. She remembered her kids' names from school that she mm-hmm. taught and went back to those days. Mm-hmm. That's quite a vocation. That's quite a legacy,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. It certainly is a good description for it. Absolutely.
So this is a really difficult time for public schools, not only for safety during a pandemic, but funding. And districts mm-hmm. are going to be having to make some difficult choices. Your opponent has said that she's going to, you know, that schools are going to open, mm-hmm. and that's it. And here mm-hmm. she is when you were debating her on Upfront a couple weeks ago.
First of all, we need to get back to school because our most vulnerable students are most impacted by this virtual learning regime. Our special needs students, our English language learners, our impoverished students with unstable home life, lack of access to robust internet, and all of the students who have been marginalized, our Black and Brown students across the state, are suffering disproportionately from this virtual instruction. So we need to open the schools now, period.
Okay. Here is Dr. Michael Osterholm, who was part of then President-elect Biden's coronavirus task force. Here's what he said this morning on Morning Joe about opening schools.
Do you see any reason why schools shouldn't be open at this point, given the evidence we have, the science we have, what pediatricians have said about the benefits outweighing the risks of schools being open?
You know, Willie, we have a collision course with destiny on our hands right now with regard to schools. I've talked about this last time I was on the show. This B117 variant from the United Kingdom is now really taking off in the United States, and is taking off in a large way in schools. Right here in Minnesota, we have a major outbreak unfolding of the likes I've never seen before in terms of the dynamic transmission of the virus. Literally new counties every day where we're starting to see more widespread transmission in school children with then transmission to adults. And so I think that we're trying basically to plant our petunias in a Category 5 hurricane right now. I think the next 3 to 5 weeks, we're going to see major outbreaks in schools throughout the United States with B117. This virus is affecting kids like it is in Europe and is different than what we saw the previous viruses. And I think we just are going to have a real challenge. We're going to be opening schools and I think closing schools all within a matter of weeks.
Your reaction to that?
My first reaction is, oh my gosh, it's like deja vu, right? Because here we are a year later. I remember it was Friday the 13th when I made the decision to tell all our kids, K-12, to take their Chromebooks home and tell all the teachers to take their materials home because we were likely going to go virtual the next week. And I was, you know, that is my reaction. It's deja vu. And the other piece of it, though, is when I was listening to Dr. Kerr's clip, our schools are open. You know, our buildings may be closed, but kids are in school, right? They're in virtual or they're face-to-face or they're in a blended environment. Kids are learning. I know that there are some struggles, you know, with certain kids perhaps don't have access to the internet, but our schools are working through that. I mean, in my own school district in Southwest Wisconsin, if you've ever driven through or rode your motorcycle or your bike through Southwest Wisconsin, you know that you're going to drop signals because of all the hills and the valleys and the rock outcroppings.
You forgot ATV.
Yes, your ATV club. Yeah. yeah, that's definitely much bigger, it seems, now than biking. but that's the thing. It's like we don't have excellent internet out here. And in many places in Wisconsin, if they don't have access, it's unaffordable. I feel that, you know, we've worked through that. You know, we've given kids hotspots. We've worked through boosters. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. And if we need to protect our kids, for sure, we need to protect their families. Many multi-generational families in Wisconsin, particularly in, you know, families of color. I mean, in my own family, we live with my 80-year-old in-laws. And, you know, it's really that we have to think about them, but we also have to think about our teachers too. And the other piece of this, if we're gonna go back face to face and get all these kids back in front of their teachers, if we do have another outbreak, I don't want that on my hands. So many of our schools are older in Wisconsin. We don't have adequate ventilation, fresh air, or, you know, ways to mitigate through filtration. Many newer schools, of course, have that, but it's impossible for many schools to be able to renovate their buildings and get new HVAC
systems. I was in Milwaukee this weekend, and I drove by my mother's old school, and I drove by where she went to high school at Milwaukee Washington High School. Those are old buildings. Now, you get out to Homestead, right? Mm-hmm. And you've got an entirely different situation. Brookfield West, entirely different situation. So, conservatives have always been claimed to be for local control. Dr. Kerr appears to be saying that we need a one-size-fits-all solution from Superior to Kenosha.
Yeah. And I disagree with that. I don't think we can do that. I mean, there's so much inequity just in facilities, but there's just, when you think about, you know, it, like I said, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into it, and we have to let our local school districts and our school boards decide what's best for them. See, in my school district, we were able to effectively physically distance. I mean, we've had rooms that are now classrooms that we didn't have as classrooms before, and we spread kids out, you know, at lunchtime, for example, in tables in the hallway and also in the gym. So that we could make sure that they are distanced at lunch. But we were able to do it because we can. We also had to hire additional cleaning staff. We had to hire a school nurse. We, you know, put more funding into PPE. And there's been a lot of expenses associated with the pandemic. And so when you talk about local control, I think, you know, certainly school districts are going to do the best they can. We worked with parents and our school board and, you know, teachers were involved in every step of the way last summer to come up with the best plan. And that plan is not going to work in other school districts. It's going to be very local.
So is this something you're going to have to evaluate? You've got a day job right now. All right. So Dr. Osterholm, what he's saying is this new variant, this new strain could definitely be spread from kid to kid. And while kids may not get sick, they could spread it to adults in multi-generational homes.
Yep, they could. And I think we need to keep that in the back of our mind that going forward, so all our teachers were vaccinated last week. We all got our first dose. So that's promising, you know, and I feel that the adults in our schools will be protected. But like you said, and like Dr. Osterholm said, you know, this is passing between kids and going home. So until we are confident enough that we know that the kids will not be able to spread it or that their parents and their family are safe, I do not feel that we should be forcing school districts to go to face-to-face.
Your opponent has essentially said that you're beholden to public employee teachers unions. Since Act 10 has happened, and she's a little slippery on whether she supported Act 10, I assume there's a paper trail that would probably clarify that. Mm-hmm. But since Act 10, I've read these stories about how few people are going into teaching. Mm-hmm. And I got to believe that we haven't even paid the full consequence yet for Act 10.
No, we're certainly paying for it. And you're right, the full consequence is not known yet. But no, there is a paper trail with Dr. Kerr and her Act 10. You know, she did call it the gift that keeps on giving. I think it was back in 2013. You know, and of course, former Governor Walker did endorse her. He voted for her. And in his tweet, he referred to our schools as government-run schools. You know, so I feel like there's lots of things that tie her to that, you know, that very acrimonious time. And I did get the support of the teachers, and I got the support of lots of labor, because I truly believe in labor, and I truly believe that when you have good schools, good teachers are part of that. You know, that's really one of the best pieces when you look at, you know, when we look at high-achieving schools and we look at safe and happy and socially, emotionally well kids. I mean, teachers are an incredible component to that. So, of course, you know, I'm proud to be supported by the teachers and other labor. The piece of it is that when you look at enrollment in schools of education and pre-teaching programs, enrollment is way down. There's been a lot of research on this. There's shortages for teachers, especially in STEM. So that would be science, technology, engineering, and math. There's shortages for teachers in special education, in reading specialists. And the thing is, it's like when you look at the long term, right, these are teachers who may be going into the profession, but they're going to be, you know, they're not teaching in our poorest schools. They're not teaching in our highest need schools. And so our kids, you know, who have the highest needs, the kids who are the most vulnerable, for example, our special education students, they're not getting the most experienced teachers. You know, either they retired after Act 10 or they moved to another school district because the cut in pay was probably too much, and so they had to go to a higher-paying school district.
Well, has that affected your district? You do not represent a wealthy district.
No, I don't. We have about a 40% poverty rate right now in my school district, and we've had to raise our salaries because we are so close. We're just, you know, southwest of Mount Horeb and west of New Glarus. And so, you know, there's better resource districts right next door. And our teachers, you know, when they come to my school, they love the culture, they love the climate, they love the kids. But certainly they can earn more money someplace else. Last year we lost a physics teacher in the middle of the school year. And that's an impossible position to fill over the summer, you know. And it was, we couldn't compete. You know, he was going to get like a $15,000 raise. And how do you argue with that? You got to do what's best for your family and your future. And so that's what we do. I mean, we just try to make do. Certainly, you know, we're not unique. There's lots of schools, urban as well as rural, that are struggling with this.
I want to ask you a question before we go today about civics. Mm-hmm. And there's one thing that I hear conservatives and liberals or progressives talk about is their concern for lack of civics education in our public schools. And I know mm-hmm. former alderperson Eve Galanter from Madison has set up a really neat program where they have competition in civics and mm-hmm. trying to get kids in. And she told me about this program, and I thought, this is just terrific. Mm-hmm. Are kids getting enough civics in public schools? Civics education?
If you look at, so I'm just going to say maybe not. You know, it depends on the school. Again, it's local control, you know, as far as what the requirements are. I know that when I was growing up, U.S. government was required. We had to take it in high school, our senior year. And that was, you know, that was extremely important. You're on the cusp of adulthood, and you're on the cusp of voting and, you know, going out into the world to be a good citizen. It was a nice capstone. But here in Wisconsin, it is not required. It is more or less, you know, just kind of threaded throughout social studies curriculum. I do know about, I'm trying to think what the name of the program is. It's like the U.S., it's the Civic Wars or the Civic Games, not Civic Wars. It's the Civic Games, I think, is that program that mm-hmm. you're referencing. And it's one of those things that my school has been preparing for. Last year actually was the year that we were getting ready to compete. And then, of course, the pandemic hit,
sure.
so we never got to do it. But, I think, you know, things like that are important. They're great ways to engage kids in civics. Current events are extremely important, and I'm finding more and more schools are having electives in social studies that are around current events or ways to incorporate current events into their curriculum, too. But that's how we do it. You know, it's not a requirement.
Interestingly enough, before Act 10 happened, mm-hmm. State Senator Dave Hansen from Green Bay, who just retired, got legislation done that included labor history mm-hmm. in our public school curriculum. Do you think that maybe we could get some sort of bipartisan legislation that would make sure that there is a prerequisite for civics? Shouldn't every school district be teaching civics? I understand you don't want top down, but isn't that kind of a basic?
Absolutely. And I think it's extremely important. I'm not just saying that because I'm a former social studies teacher. It's extremely important. And I look at, you know, in the state of Wisconsin, I mean, we require, X number of credits for health and PE. Why can't we do that same thing for civics? I think it's equally as important, you know, especially when you look at the health of our democracy. We certainly need civics.
All right. If people want to help you, How do they go about it?
Yeah, so I have a website that has all my information on there. It's www.underly, for Wisconsin, and so it's forwi.com. And we have ways to get involved. You can sign up to get a yard sign. Hopefully we'll have those ready and out, you know, distributed by Friday this week. We'll also have ways for you to sign up for phone banking. Also, if they want to attend an event, we're doing everything virtual right now. If
sure.
it gets a little warmer, we might have some outdoor things, but right now everything's virtual. We also have opportunities for people to donate. I mean, it takes a lot of resources to run statewide. And as you alluded, I'm also doing my day job. So I'm busy, you know, and I certainly could use some extra support for people to help me get the word out.
I sent a check on Friday.
Well, thank you, Sly. I appreciate that so much. I really do. Thank you.
Dr. Underly, Jill Underly, for school superintendent. Thanks for coming to, hang on the line for just a second. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.